Welcome to the FinTech Scaling Show. This podcast is sponsored by the Growth Platform Framework. B2B FinTech startups accelerate customer acquisition and set up business operations to scale systematically. When you're ready to grow, reach out to us at richard@ipractitioners.com. Now, over to the show with Richard Dozy, founder and host. Hey, what's up, everyone? Today on the show, we have Dirk, founder and CEO of Fixico. Fixico was founded in 2014 and since then has exploded. They've launched their business into new markets, both on the European continent and also internationally. And over the course of the last few years, they've won some stellar awards for their accomplishments, including the Fleet Europe Award, the Dell Entrepreneur Award, and the European InsurTech Award. So we're really, really excited to have Dirk on the show today. So welcome, Dirk.
Thank you. And what a nice word.
Yeah, awesome. And listen, I thought it would be best to kick off the show with you jumping into the time machine and taking us back to maybe 2014 or just prior to launch and explaining to our listeners how the idea of Fixico came about.
Yeah, of course. So it actually, Fixico was born, which you see with a lot of companies, actually out of own experience, which was not how it actually should have been in my eyes. So, or actually, I had at that time had a scratch on my car, or a scratch even worse than my mother's car, to be honest. And yeah, I came in the process of car damage repair. So really, questions came along as to what will the price be, where do I need to go, where is there availability, who actually delivers the right quality, those kind of things. So what do? You go to Google and actually try to find answers on these questions, but instead you just get a random list of repair shops and you're not able to actually get answers on those questions. So that was actually the starting point of Fixico. At that time, the aim was actually to solve the black box around car damage repair. So yeah, we started off small and created an app where you can put in a couple of fixtures, upload them, and then receive within 24 hours at least 3 competing bids of high quality repair shops, and then choose the best one based on price, ratings, service, fixtures, certifications, those kind of things. So that was actually the starting point of Fixico.
Awesome. And tell me more about the platform that you developed, so I guess the materials and what have you that you had to source in to get it moving in a way.
Yeah, maybe it's good to actually state that the platform today is completely different at that time. So at that time, we were really a typical consumer marketplace. So really for end users who need to pay the damage themselves. So really the typical consumer marketplace model. And today we actually are a company that aims to redefine car damage repair industry as a whole. So also for fleets, insurance companies, rental companies. If you drill it down, we actually do 2 main things. So on the one hand, we digitalize the entire repair journey from start to finish. And we actually add the best repair management platform in combination with the car marketplace, car repair shop marketplace behind it. And yeah, if we then go back to where we started at that time, we only had an app. So we've built an app actually to do so. So the customer portal, and we had a very, let's say, easy setup of a repair shop dashboard. And yeah, at that time, it was starting off by one getting in leads, which we did via Facebook, search, those kind of things, and getting repair shops in. And that was literally going door by door and knocking on doors and saying, hey, do you want to participate marketplace?
Well, maybe that's quite a good segue into how you guys determined and found that product market fit in the early stages and actually got, I guess, consumer buy-in, right?
Yeah, so actually quite a funny story. So when we started, we first tested it ourselves. So again, going back to my own scratch of the car, when I actually started that time, I just started calling up repair shop and saw that there was quite a big difference in price and service offering, but also in additional service like a replacement car or pickup or delivery service or those kind of things. So that was the starting point, which we all did offline. But we saw, hey, there is a lot of air between all those offerings. So yeah, that makes sense to actually put a marketplace there. Then actually, when we started off, we find out that actually the majority of the repair shops didn't want to participate. And that was because they believed actually that you could not make an estimate based on pictures. While we actually tested the market ourselves by going to those repair shops, and then you saw that when they're making an estimate, they look a little bit left, right, underneath, without touching the car, and then actually they gave you an estimate. So we knew that it was possible, but we really need to change the mindset of this entire industry, which meant at that time a lot of standing on podiums and being laughed at by repair shops. But at a certain moment, we were able to find a small group of repair shops who did believe in us and actually wanted to participate. And for us, it was actually then making sure that we deliver to those repair shops and use them as an endorsers for the rest of the market, for the market. So we started in Amsterdam, very small, very local, even going with flyers on cars which were scratched and standing on the street and putting flyers underneath it. On the other hand, at 20 repair shops, who were able to actually bid on those things. And we were able to really show added value on both sides of the platform. And from there on, actually, we start leveraging them for the users, for the consumers in the media and on the repair shop, really going door by door also to other repair shops and say, hey, repair shop in Amsterdam also didn't believe it, but look at how they're thinking right now. Then you see that the product market fit or really becomes alive. And we were with the two of us at that time, my partner Mark and I, to grow from, I think, 20 repair shops to 50 in Amsterdam within a month. And afterwards, we grew in within 3 months to a national coverage network in the Netherlands to almost 400 repair shops. And that was purely by leveraging the endorsement of the ones in Amsterdam.
Wow, I mean, that's pretty sort of phenomenal take up. I mean, but just going back a second, you mentioned that you had to go through a period of changing the mindset of the industry and obviously the people in the repair shops. Obviously, you used and you leveraged those initial partnerships. But what else were you guys doing to shift the mindset to your way of thinking and your solution?
Yeah, I think it's a mindset that we still have today in the company, which is constant trying to experiment, learn, listen to the end users and then implement it into your platform. So a very clear example at that time. So what repair shops were also really afraid about when we were talking about them was, let's say, for a price war, so that we actually going to play them against them, like sort of an eBay where you say, okay, the damage is 100 euros and then the other one is going to do 90 euros and then the other one 80 euros and so on. So we heard that and understand actually their argument and said, okay, then we need to make a closed marketplace or closed bidding system where they don't see from each other what they're actually bidding. And by doing so, also we're able to say to them, say, okay, we're not want to play you against each other, but we just want to create an online platform where you can differentiate yourself from the other repair shops. Can it be on price? Can it be the quickest availability, the fastest repair, or the best additional services? So with that small tweak, which was just saying, okay, don't show the bid within the repair shop environment, that entire mindset changed.
Yeah, I can see that. And just for our listeners, I mean, further explain what you mean by a closed marketplace.
Yeah, so this is, again, we're really talking about the consumer marketplace. And Mexico today, it's different. But yeah, the closed marketplace is meaning that you say, okay, that when the repair shop, when they get a request in, that they were not able to see my neighbor actually placed 500 euros, and now I'm going to do 490 and so on. And so you actually make sure that they were fully free and not biased by just saying, if this client came into my shop, I would say this. And I would point out that I'm really good because I have certain certifications or those kind of things. And we actually bring that alive and creating transparency into the marketplace and therefore helping the client, but also helping the repair shops, the good ones, because they're also ones don't like that, because you're literally taking off the blanket of a market, so to say, that you help them, like I said before, differentiate them from other ones by literally bringing transparency in an untransparent market.
Yeah, I can see. I mean, it makes complete sense. It remains competitive without, I guess, creating over competitiveness where people are just, as you're saying, there's no bidding war at all. It's still competitive. Everyone gets their part of the pie, right?
No, absolutely. And to add on that, so what we did from the beginning was also making sure that it wasn't only about price, that there are multiple variables which you take into consideration if you are taking a decision of this is the right repair shop at this specific time for this specific repair for me, which can change over time, because it can also be that this week, and that's what we were doing with the marketplace model, saying that repair shop X says, hey, I can repair this car for 500 euros, but you need to come on Wednesday or Friday because my shop is 70% empty at that day. But hey, next week I'm fully occupied. So then the price for only the one or two time slots that I have left is 900 euros.
Yeah, I can see the model and it makes complete sense. And as you guys, I guess, you worked through the first launch in 2014 and you started to see the fruits of your labor, as you mentioned earlier, with quite a big uptick in Amsterdam. What was your scaling philosophy? What were you guys thinking about and how were you approaching the growth of your business at the start of the first year into the second year?
Yes, I think it's good to start that we say that we actually started the business always with the perspective that we want to build a global company. So we always looked at the industry or the segment as our market and not specifically saying a country or whatsoever. So we really looked at the market or the potential that we saw and saying, okay, if you look at the entire automotive market, car sales was already going, went online, car maintenance were several platforms that were actually jumping in and so on. But you saw that the car damage repair industry, which is maybe the most unsexy of the entire automotive industry, yeah, time stood still, literally. There wasn't a lot of innovation happening. Wow, it's actually one of the biggest one if you look at the after sales part. So it's 120 billion euro market in Europe alone. So we really believe, and we still believe, that in the period of, let's say, at that time, 5 to 10 years, this market will shift online and will digitalize and will bring in more efficiencies, or it will be possible by digitalizing to bring in more efficiencies in that market, or maybe even, say, better said, the entire ecosystem. So we founded the company, and that's also, if you look at our funding strategy, always from the perspective, there will be a digital play, and we want to be the front runner in there, and therefore always want to grow fast to actually being the one who's leading digitalization of the market.
Mm. So global focus.
Yeah, let's say Europe first and then
global. Yeah. Okay, Europe being global. And if you break that down, how do you look at it from, maybe let's talk about people. Have you made certain that you get the right people on board to achieve your growth objectives?
So I think you also need to look at this, the right people, is also depending on what stage the company is. So I'm a strong believer that you see that you need different skill sets in different times. So just to break that down for you. So in the beginning, when we were just with the two of us, the first people you need around us needs to be literally all-rounders, people with a growth mindset, can-do mentality, and really want to play and be the entrepreneur together with you. So can do all the things. So then the next stage is actually that you need specialists, because you see you had one person doing all of your marketing. And if you want to grow, you need one for, let's say, SEO and for social and for branding. So you start to specialize. And then the next phase is actually that you need managers or leaders who actually make sure that all the specialists are all focused on the right things. And then maybe even a layer on top of it when you're going further. And yeah, I think that's really important to recognize. And then in addition to that, cultural values, I hate the word, but let's say the right mindset that people and the right belief in the same spirit or characters is really important to have that in your company still, and especially if you're becoming bigger. So I think that's also something which we did pretty well and we are constantly are really focused on. Actually, we are reviewing our cultural values also a lot of times, saying, okay, is this still what we are and what we want to be? And we do that with the entire company. So everyone is actually providing input and making sure that it is not only something which you're bringing in from top down, but really lives within the company. Another thing which for us was really important looking at growth and people is Mark and I were both first time founders. So we were relatively young, and therefore making sure that you have a lot of people around you in a board and advisory board who already did this a couple times is in my eyes key, because we learned so much and you can get so much more speed if you have people around you that can already made that mistakes a couple times and actually can help to prevent or learn faster from the mistake that you make.
Mm. Tell me more about, you mentioned culture. I mean, we've spoken about culture on the Fintech Scaling Show a few times. Do you think it's important? It's a critical part of growth. And if you get it right, that speed, as you mentioned, you know, can sort of be explosive. So I guess my question to you is, can you give us some examples maybe of how you review your culture and how you go around and embed a culture of growth or a culture of speed into your company?
Yeah, it all starts, of course, making sure that the core of your company, so the people who were there, actually created the culture themselves, and that's not something that you bring in top down because it's nice, but it really needs to fit in the company itself. And then, yeah, I think there are multiple ways of making sure that you constantly are also aware of this. It's always nice. A lot of people say, yeah, we put it on the wall and then it will be there. I think that you need to do that anyway, but it is not something which makes a difference. So I really implement that you're hiring and frameworks for hiring, but also in performance reviews for your existing team members, where you really say, so we have, for example, a section in our performance review where people are constantly judged. How do you perform against, or how do you live up to the cultural values? So I think these are two things which are really helpful. And of course, there are a lot of other smaller tactics in monthly all hands meetings and all those kind of things to bring it alive. But yeah, for me, I think the most two that really makes a difference, implementing your hiring and your onboarding and those kind of things, really judge people on it, and not only based on their CVs, and later on also do it into the performance reviews of the currency, because then people are also aware that it is important. Is that helpful?
Yeah, very helpful. I mean, I think those two nuggets around bringing your culture into both your onboarding and your resource hiring, and also then at the back end, putting it into your performance reviews. I mean, that makes complete sense. I mean, you can see the flow, right?
Yeah, and it's also really necessary. So what you see at Fixico, when the company grew, so in the beginning, we had a lot of very, like I said, young, eager, motivated, but maybe not that experienced people working at the company. And let's say the last couple of years, we shifted by also bringing a lot of more experienced people who did the job already, let's say the trick of scaling a company a couple of times. And then it's even becoming more important, because there's also difference in age and experience between those. And you want to make sure that the company doesn't transform in the wrong way, especially if you're bringing in people who worked at corporates and those kind of things, which can be a great addition to the company. Yeah? So it's not that you need only people who really worked at fast growing startups, especially in automotive, where expertise and network in a traditional company, or in, let's say, in the traditional side of the industry, is super helpful to also feed the other side. But therefore, you need to be even more aware that those people do have the same mindset, because otherwise it doesn't fit with the rest of the company.
And another good point there, the transformation of your team during the journey of growth. Tell me, how have you guys looked at that? I mean, I know you've mentioned the three levels: entrepreneur, specialist, leaders, and maybe looking at other parts of the team dynamics to make certain you have the right people on board. But at each part, how have you transformed yourself to make certain that the team you have today is the one that's going to deliver for you on an ongoing basis?
Yeah, good one. So I think it's good to say that the company itself also transformed quite a lot. So we really grew from a consumer marketplace only to also having a B2B and also almost a SaaS-enabled marketplace, actually to a three-sided marketplace. So the company itself transformed a lot, and especially from B2C to B2B, and you see that you are interacting totally different with the market. So you're talking to large leasing companies, insurance companies, and instead of just doing a lot of growth hacking and those kind of things we were doing in the consumer space. So therefore, you saw that you also need different expertise. So really, how does that market work? So how are the politics and those kind of things? So also the profiles changed a lot. And yeah, then it's actually looking per team. What do you want that team to accomplish? How does success look like for that team? And making sure that you have complementary skills in that team while keeping the same culture of values, saying, okay, we want, on the one hand, we want to have the expertise and the skills of all the executives in the automotive industry, but on the other hand, we also want to bring in that digital tech mindset. And yeah, that's a constant balancing between the two for us in the teams to make it work.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess the other side of the coin is then giving those teams, the leaders, specialists, the tools to sort of do their job front to back, right? And that's both stitching the process together and also the systems that make the ecosystem sort of work. And how did you guys look at that? I mean, did you prioritize certain maybe processes or systems up front? Have you changed story a couple of times as everyone does anyway?
Yeah, absolutely. So for us, focus is always extremely important, I think, for every company. But we have a lot of opportunities flying around us constantly and making sure that everyone is focused on what really brings the success of the company, I think, is, and especially, like, I think we already discussed a little bit before this, in these times, is extremely difficult and really hard, but is crucial for success. And how we do that is that we, let's say we set ourselves for the year, we set our target, which is a revenue target for us. And then we actually break it down in building blocks where we say, okay, where do we want to compete in which segments and in which countries, and where do we want to stand at the end of the year to actually reach that goal? And then we define also 5 how to win strategies. And that goes cross team, how we believe that we win in those segments. And that is something which we drill down constantly in the organization. And of course, you have a lot of projects around as well, but these are always, should always be prioritized. And yeah, till now that works pretty well for us.
I was wondering what you meant by how to win strategies and whether that was solely focused on sales or if it also takes into consideration sort of the operational stuff that needs to get sorted out as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So just to give you an example in our case, so let's say if the building block is we want to create a success model in the leasing industry. Then we define, okay, we need to, let's say, the product always needs to be possible to integrate it in all kinds of systems for those leasing companies, because otherwise we're not able to get those damages easily. And we need proper partner activation or the best partner activation. And that drills down into many other projects, which goes through the entire organization. But having, let's say, that 5 things that we say, okay, we need to be fully integrated. We need to have a great partner onboarding and a couple of other ones, that is something which then goes through the entire organization and helps them to actually say, hey, is my project actually contributing to that higher goal?
Yeah, okay, so it's complete front to back. I mean, that's pretty, I guess at the end of the day, you can actually measure the results because you can see it on the...
You should.
Yeah.
So this is cross-stream, and every How to Win strategy has an owner and a supporter, and we let them present how it's going. And of course, there are a lot of KPIs defined on those kind of things, which we measure constantly. And again, coming also back to a little bit of culture, we believe that you also need to be extremely transparent in the entire organization how this is going, and constantly show everything, even if it's not going well, and all the numbers correlated to this. So that people also have the feeling that it is not just a job, but that we're all in this together and we have one journey together, and that we and that they really feel and also see what the impact is of the project that they are doing.
And the transparency side of things. So you mentioned at the top of the show that you sort of B2C, you had a marketplace model, and then that shifted over the course of the years as you've grown up and you've found out, you found a different model and you shifted to the B2B play. So
it's more, let's say, we saw a faster opportunity for growth. So the consumer marketplace is still there, but you saw that you were able to grow so much faster in the B2B space. So we do both still.
Yeah. Okay. And how did that play out? How did that shift play out? Because we talk about transparency, but you're doing both at a point in time. You've obviously found that B2B is an opportunity. How did you move the company to make certain that you grasp the opportunity and then still continued the excellent service on the B2C side?
Yeah, that was super difficult. it's a total different mindset. And you also need to change the organization accordingly. So it's not that saying, oh, let's launch a partner environment and then it will be okay. You really need to change the marketing, the operations team. You need to have partner success onboarding teams. And also, like I said before, the sort of people is totally different. So that was something which was really hard to do in a short time. But I think we managed well. And luckily, the platform itself is the core is somewhat the same. Only in the B2B, it's much more extensive. So processes are much more complicated. You need to really have product add-ons like SaaS interfaces for the partner. You need to make sure that they can onboard existing suppliers, those kind of things. So, but in the end, the core, and what is for us is, let's say, digitalizing the journey and doing smart matchmaking from the repair to the repair shop is the same. And I think that makes it possible for us to be in both markets at the same time. And it's actually something which boosts one another.
And I was wondering why you guys went down that route. I know you said it's sort of on the B2B side, it's more there's a growth opportunity. Is that growth opportunity into different locations, i.e. into maybe Germany or internationally, or was it something else in play?
Yeah, so it's a combination of both. So what you saw is, so B2C was great. You know, we had a great value proposition. There was low competition, you had control over your own growth. It was really nice. But on the other hand, there were also quite some challenges. And I think the most important one for us was that scaling at a certain moment becomes very costly. So if you talk an end user, you need to be there at the right moment, because we are only interested in the moment that you have a damage. Otherwise, we are not interested. Then, of course, search is great, because then you are like when I had my car accident. You're searching for something and then grabbing that. That's perfect now. So we were able to grow fast, very well, and efficient via search. But then you need to grow to the next stage. And then, you're coming into mass media channels like radio, TV, those kind of things, which we did. And it worked well, but it is super costly, of course. And you then really needs to be that you create, that you're always top of mind. Let's say in the Netherlands, we have CarGlass, who's, you know, if you have something with your window, they are advertising every day, so that you always, in the moment that there is something happens, you know immediately CarGlass. It's like everyone knows that, which I foresee us doing in the future. But yeah, we are a company, like I said, who wants to win that digital play in the next 5 years. We have, like every startup, we have limited resources. So yeah, then you're thinking about what are you going to do? You can add more verticals that you become more relevant often, something which we were thinking about as well. But on the other hand, we saw that 120 billion market and saw also the work at that time, companies coming to us saying, hey, can we also leverage the consumer model, the consumer platform for our local rental company or those kind of things? So we saw that there also was appetite, and then we actually went looking further, and then you see B2B, you have high volumes which all unlock fast growth, you have high engagement, the retention rate is great because they're constantly coming, you can create due to the SaaS, and you can product lock in, so very low churn, the take rate is higher because the repair price is higher. And like you're saying, also from an international perspective, it's very interesting because if you win a client, an international client in one country, so let's take, for example, a rental company we're working with, Avis. We started in one country, but we were in a very short time, we scaled with them to 6 countries, and then COVID hit, so we're planning to do a little bit more. But if you prove the case in one country, you can grow with those clients also from an international perspective.
Yeah, it makes complete sense, right? And as you guys have moved forward and accelerated your growth, I mean, you're now in European cities outside of obviously your local shop, which is in Amsterdam, but you're also in international markets, and you're in my hometown in South Africa, which is great. But how have you guys approached that expansion into multiple locations, and not just in Europe, but also, you know, 14 hours flight away in South Africa.
Yeah, we needed a little bit of sun.
Agreed.
So first let me go South Africa. So South Africa was a little bit of an experience for us. We started an experiment. So we actually got a lot of questions coming out of South Africa, or clients reaching out saying, hey, can you come to South Africa? Because we really want to have your platform over here. And we were like, yeah, we are in Europe and we're not really planning to go to South Africa. And at a certain moment, we came into contact with two persons on a conference, which really clicked, really good guys, a lot of knowledge, a lot of expertise, and actually stated, and they said, yeah, we really would like to have Fixico in South Africa. And to actually say, okay, you know what? Probably in the next 10 years or 5 to 10 years, we're not going to South Africa by ourselves. So why not actually say we do it in a sort of joint venture kind of model where we actually offer the platform, provide the platform, the materials, the branding, the knowledge, the assets, you name it. And you set up the team over there and run the daily operation, and you become also part of the company yourself. And let's see if this model works for us next to our own geographical expansion. And yeah, it worked pretty well. So we work with 400 repair shops now, do quite a lot of volume already, have a nice large insurance company in the form of Old Mutual now using the platform, and a couple ones are currently piloting. So the model works really well for us. And in terms of Europe, again, please take in consideration the consumer only and B2B. So from consumer only, the first logical step for us was Germany. Simple reason, it's the biggest market and they're super automotive minded. So that made total sense for us. And then we actually continued to Belgium as well. But then the B2B model actually kicked in, and therefore we shifted also a little bit of, and of course, we also look at the characteristic of the company, the country itself. But also if we have strong partners who wants to work with us in a certain country, yeah, that makes it very attractive for us to go to a country because, yeah, we have them demand. Supply sometimes is already there because they have their existing supply. But it's a good starting point. So both sides of the marketplace, yeah, there is already a starting point, which makes it far more easier to start a market because, yeah, with all marketplaces, balancing supply and demand in the beginning is the hardest thing. So if you can go with a partner already has a little bit of supply, but more importantly, already have demand, yeah, it's very easy for us to kickstart a country. So actually, before COVID, we were planning to do, together with partners, a new country every quarter. But yeah, COVID made it a little bit more difficult.
Yeah, it has sort of scuppered some of the growth of the last year or so. But listen, were you using the same model? Sort of, were you JVing in Europe, or was it?
No. That's all Fixico.
Okay. So you're out there building teams, building partnerships.
Yeah. So we would never do a model like that in a company which is important for us ourselves.
Yeah.
And therefore, yeah, South Africa was not on the top of our list. Fully honest.
No. It makes complete sense. And just for some of the listeners, I mean, JV is, you know, I know it's joint venture. How does that all play out at the highest level?
Yeah, so actually, it's just you make them partly owners so that they are really also, yeah, can play the entrepreneur themselves instead of just hiring people. And yeah, they did a little bit of investment of themselves. All, and yeah, Fixico is also part of Fixico South Africa. And we also get some royalties.
Okay. So listen, I guess as we move forward, what questions are you guys asking yourselves right now? And what factors are you considering as you continue on your growth trajectory?
That's a good one. I think the most important for us is constantly asking yourselves, and really if you have the vision of trying to change an industry, saying, okay, how can we do what is being done today 5 to 10 times better than the industry? So really breaking that industry curve is the most important thing. So how can you be 5 to 10 times more efficient, faster, more cheaper than anyone else in the market? And I think that is something which you constantly needs to drill down, because that's the core of our platform. And if we nail that down and improve that in your communication and everything we do, then you really have the potential to change an industry. And it sounds easy, but it isn't, because it's really difficult, because you get a lot of opportunities and things that flying by, or doing certain integrations or build something for large clients and those kind of things, which can distract you from what really has the potential of changing an industry. I think and of course, we have a lot of other challenges and questions that we're asking ourselves, but bring that back to those kind of things and really constantly asking ourselves, okay, hey, what are signals and what are noise? That is the most important thing.
Yeah, I mean, I love that question. I think it's at least it keeps the focus, right?
Yeah, and it sounds so simple, but it is so difficult to execute on it properly.
And listen, as we wrap up the show, how can our listeners get in touch with you and also the team at Fixico if they want to?
Just connect with me via LinkedIn, or shoot me a message on Derek@Fixico.nl. And I think that's the most easy way. I'm always keen to explore opportunities and discuss interesting things.
And a lot of our guests are always looking for opportunities to update their knowledge. So I always ask this question at the end of a show, although I asked it to you at the beginning of the show before we started recording, but I'll ask it to you anyway. You know, what book are you reading, or what podcast are you listening to that you think might be useful for some of our listeners to download or buy to update their knowledge on scaling or other topics that are interesting?
Yeah, so like I said to you in the beginning, I have a little one at home, plus pandemic, plus another little one in, let's say, the company. So reading books, or I haven't seen a lot of books in the last couple of months, to be fully honest. But yeah, we're always a big fan of a lot of books like Scaling Up, Lean Startup, the new Business Road Test of John Mullins, who I wrote in the past. So I think that are nice books or works for us. Podcast, that's a little bit more for me now. So when I'm walking to the office or those kind of things, I can listen. I like really the Two-Sided Marketplace podcast. It's a really good one. For me, it's actually gaining knowledge for now, because of the busyness, is just reading a lot of things on TechCrunch and those kind of things, which are a little bit more easy in between than reading books at the moment, unfortunately. But hopefully that comes back soon.
Yeah, listen, I hear you. I've also got two little ones, and it is sometimes a bit of a struggle. But listen, Dirk, it's been an absolutely amazing show. I've thoroughly enjoyed the conversation, and there's some really great takeaways from this show. So, you know, thanks for coming on, and thanks for, you know, sharing your expertise and your knowledge and being honest and having a good chat today. I'm really looking forward to seeing what else Fixico does in the future.
Yeah, likewise, really enjoyed it. And thank you very much for the invitation. And I'm sure we will be speaking in the future.
Awesome.